also say we don't know how the debate is going to be between Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. Hillary Clinton has similarly been on both sides of a number of issues. The Iraq War is an example. The bankruptcy bill. Hillary Clinton voted for one version of the bankruptcy bill. She voted against another version of the bankruptcy bill. So it'll be very difficult to know how the flashpoints are going to play out in the race.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. David Sirota, senior writer at the International Business Times. His recent piece, we'll link to it, is headlined Student Debt. Obama administration tries to block bankruptcy courts from reducing education debt. And that does it for our show. We have an opening, a full-time job as director of development to lead our fundraising efforts. Find out more about our development director job at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website, democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today we'll talk about Vladimir Putin and today's Russia. Are they still a threat to American imperialism?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bridging the Future, an evening with 2015 Youth Poet Laureate Contest winners, Friday, October 23rd from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Zoomtopia in Portland. This event will feature performances by the poets Alexis Cannard and Saki Edwards, as well as Tyler White and Baki from the What Do You Want to Do crew and Spit Right Youth Poet Project, and a conversation facilitated by Mike Crenshaw between the artists and the audience reflecting the connections between art, culture, politics, community, and cross-generational solidarity. Again, that's Bridging the Future, an evening with 2015 Youth Poet Laureate Contest winners, Friday, October 23rd from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Zoomtopia, 810 Southeast Belmont Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Health Club's Body Positive Block Party, Thursday, October 22nd at Health Club in Portland. The Body Positive Block Party is an inaugural bash for Portland's first body positive, worker-owned, community-centered barbell gym. Again, that's the Body Positive Block Party on Thursday, October 22nd, 7 p.m. at Health Club, 1235 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Start your Saturday morning with a little swingin' country. The KBOO Swingin' Country program will be broadcasting live from the Tin Shed Garden Cafe on Saturday, October 24th from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. I know you've been hankering to put a face to those velvety tones, so here's your chance. You are welcome to come early, pull up a chair, and enjoy some coffee, food, and an earful of swingin' country. The Tin Shed Garden Cafe is located at 1438 Northeast Alberta Street in the City of Roses. Again, that's Swingin' Country live from the Tin Shed, Saturday, October 24th, here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com or by calling 503-230-2300.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed four major wars among great nations. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development. Yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
There we are.
Here we are.
And here we are.
Yeah.
This is KBOO, 90.7 FM in Portland. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Abe Proctor right over there. Me, I'm Joe Uris. Number to call, 231-8187. That was Eisenhower's final address as President of the United States, a general who was a major figure in defeating the Nazis in World War II.
He was supreme Allied commander in Europe.
Yes.
There have been few military officials in history with that sort of profile and that sort of responsibility at any one given time.
That's true.
He was also a rock-ribbed conservative Republican.
Yes.
The era to which modern conservatives usually hearken back as a sort of 20th century golden age, the 1950s, the Eisenhower administration.
And yet, the John Birch Society during that same period of time, the John Birch Society, which everyone should understand, the Koch brothers come out of the tradition of, actually the sons of leaders of the John Birch Society, that group accused Eisenhower of being a closeted communist. Really?
Really?
Yeah, really. And I want to do a couple things. I want to, first of all, apologize to some of you who got hung on the phones last week. We should have said that I didn't know we were going to not take calls, but the conversation with our guest,
Katrina Vandenhoevel.
Thank you. Yeah. Was so, for us, useful and intense that we kind of blew off all of you callers. Not that you aren't just as important as the editor-publisher of the Nation magazine, but we forgot to tell you that, and we forgot to tell our producer, Steve, so he had to bear the brunt of anger. We rarely do that. We rarely don't take calls. We will be taking calls today. But if you were one of the people left hanging there, we apologize for that, and we'll move on with our talk radio format. And I want to just right now welcome you to World War III.
Oh, that's a little grandiose, don't you think?
Yeah, well, what? We have had, since Eisenhower, innumerable stupid wars which we in fact didn't win, and we're now engaged endlessly in a war in Afghanistan and in the Mideast, which there's talk from lots of idiots, including Donald Trump, talking about how we should do whatever we need to do to stop the Russians, no longer Soviets, from sharing the airspace in around Syria. And there's even talk about how we should shoot down any Soviet airplanes in that airspace with a no-fly zone. I mean, in other words, precipitating World War III.
All right, I'm going to stipulate the conditions. He could easily point to a conflict with Russia at
okay.
this point.
Okay.
But what's going on now, and even what's been threatened by people like Donald Trump, doesn't approach either of the two previous world wars in terms of either scope or geopolitical consequences. We're nothing close to that level of engagement.
Well,
millions of troops on the ground from both sides.
Yeah, I don't know that a modern war is like World Wars One and Two. World War One was a senseless slaughter. That World War One essentially produced the situation that we see in the Middle East in terms of fake nation states and enormous separations between two kinds of followers of Islam.
Yes. And both of the world wars can be interpreted in the context of sort of the death rattle of the old European colonial imperialist monarchical regimes.
Yeah, but the rattle keeps happening.
Keeps
rattling.
Yeah, there's rattling going on there, yes. But the world as it is now is fundamentally different than it was before the start of the
First World War. I'm being an alarmist?
I do, but I think this is also talk radio, and that's part of the gig. So, but I want to, before we get into this, and I'm looking forward to hearing your background on Russia, but before we get into that, I want to tell you one more thing about Eisenhower.
Sure.
Eisenhower, in my estimation, was a pretty damn good president. Despite his innate conservatism and his affiliation with the Republican Party, consider what Eisenhower presided over. The highest marginal tax rates under Eisenhower were above 90% for the wealthiest individuals and corporations. Under Eisenhower, we saw the construction of the interstate highway system. We saw the fulfillment of the Marshall Plan. We saw the construction of a public university system, the likes of which history had never before seen. Based on these measures, Eisenhower was a progressive.
Well, based on those measures and looking at the situation today, you're absolutely right. I would like to point out, though, some caveats on this. The creating of the highway system meant the destruction of the railroads.
Indeed, it did.
And the destruction of passenger railroads is something that is dogging us today. Every other modern industrial state, and I mean places like China, Burma,
yes.
I mean, all kinds of places have high-speed rail.
Yes.
And we don't. And it's really dumb.
Nevertheless, I'm willing to admit that the interstate highway system is a mixed bag, but we've generated an enormous amount of utility from it. And it was a huge coordinated investment in essential American infrastructure funded by tax rates on the very wealthy that would be heretical today in the context of today's
politics. Well, that's true, but I also think we saw the growth of the bizarre the bizarre highway construction industry, which
yeah, this is true. And you even had situations like Los Angeles, which had a brilliant rail system once upon a time.
I used to ride the red cars when I was
the
a
red
kid.
Cars. The yeah. red cars were bought up and shut down
and burned
by essentially a conspiracy between Standard Oil, General Motors, and Firestone Tire and Rubber.
Yep.
And Los
and
Angeles.
Mack trucks. And don't Mack, forget Mack yeah. trucks.
And Los Angeles has suffered the consequences ever since.
Yeah, and they've been rebuilding now their light rail system, or they want to call it transportation system.
Yep.
But, you know, it's much more expensive to rebuild or create such a thing than to just maintain a system. What Europe did after World War II was go back to their existing systems and modernize them. Same thing with Japan, and now with China, even.
Point taken.
Okay
so right. You want to get to Russia. We have one phone call. Should we take that phone call first?
Before Let's
we
take
get
a to, phone right. call.
Peter, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, folks. You know, I appreciate you're bringing up this topic today. Because I think it's, even though, you know, it's in, obviously, Russia has been in the news over the last couple of years, it seems, you know, even when it's reported on mainstream media, it's not, you know, it's, I mean, when we talk about, I do feel, as I think you guys are leading towards in your discussion so far, we are kind of on a precipice, you know, we are. If you look at a cycle of history, you know, the last major global conflict, World War II, ended about 70 years ago, I think now. And you know, not that you know, not that history functions on any kind of a timetable, but yeah, clearly that conflict was devastating enough for the world, or at least to Europe, you know, for the world to take a break for a while. And, you know, historical memory as well as, you know, conflicts that build up naturally in, you know, in any kind of capitalist world economy where everybody is fighting for survival, you know, these conflicts seem to have really reached a peak, and it's for the last, at least since the whole thing with Ukraine blew up a year ago, I've noticed there's a substantial change in the way it's discussed. Even, you know, I mean, we all know that there's a problem with the media in this country reporting things objectively and fairly, propaganda, but, you know, even sources that I used to rely upon, like NPR, and even actually some outlets that can be reliably considered left wing, and a lot of it also has to do with the fact that there's a, you know, Democratic Party government. You know, if the Democrats are in power, the official left tends to sort of feel silenced and, you know, unable to criticize. But, you know, the propaganda, particularly with the way Russia is reported upon and the conflict in Ukraine had been reported upon, has been, I mean, it's just been off the scales. It's just impossible to get. I mean, you can rely on finding objective information if you have some kind of historical understanding of the situation, know what outlets to look for online. You know, there's Russia Today, which also is, you know, propaganda from another side. But, I mean, in this context, I think they do manage to report the situation more objectively. But it's just, you know, the way that supposedly officially objective outlets are just supposed to report facts. And, you know, when they talk about issues like Ukraine and to some extent, you know, with Syria also, they're, you know, anytime Russia is mentioned, it has to be with the caveat, well, you know, they actually aren't attacking terrorists or something like that. It's, you know, I really think that, you know, we should all recognize we're really on the verge of something here.
Okay.
You know, it's frightening. I know I've kind of rambled a bit. I'm. do you guys have anything?
Well, we'll continue this conversation. I'm gonna free you from the air.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the call.
But I do thank
that
you.
That was a good setup, actually.
Actually, excellent setup. And I think it's really important that a couple of things are brought up in the context of what he raised. First of all, Americans are notoriously ahistorical in their analysis. When we talk about Ukraine, we forget that what we were talking about was part of what was regarded by the Russians until the collapse of the Soviet Union as part of Greater Russia. We also forget that that whole region, that space between the European powers and the then Soviet Union, was really the bloodlands. That was the land where there was the murder of many, many people, including many, many Jews. That was the area where anti-Semitism flourished, where, in fact, Stalin was a major player in the most bloody conflict beyond the conflict of World War II itself. And when we talk about Ukraine, which we completely forget was part of the Soviet Union until the collapse of the Soviet Union, when we talk about Ukraine, we really do forget that what the Western powers did, what NATO did when the Soviet Union collapsed, was make a promise to neutralize all the countries of the former Soviet powers and not put military power of the West in those areas. And then we went back on that with the feeblest of excuses, so that we now have missiles, American missiles, in former Soviet republics, and we have a former Soviet Union, a Russia, which already is extremely paranoid, but seems to be valid in its paranoia of the advance of the West against Russia. This is, you know, from the point of view of the average Russian citizen, absolutely real. So we're setting up a really weird thing. Meanwhile, Putin, who is, in my mind, a kind of a crazy guy, but nevertheless a strategist far superior to our strategists, Putin has seen the opportunity to move into and firm up his position in the Middle East through Syria, through the horrible government of Assad, and in the process of that, to create a potentially dominating position in the region, which locks us, that is the United States, and the Western powers, into the inevitable conflict, the inevitable Cold War, a repetition. This is really real.
A quick word on Putin. He, after a four-year gap, was just elected to his third six-year term as president of Russia. I think maybe the term president has become a misnomer.
It did have an election,
yes. But there's lots of evidence to suggest that that election was something short of fair. He's a dictator. He's the dictator of Russia.
I think it's a little more complicated than that, but I'm not arguing with you. It's certainly the case that what he's created is a model more akin to the Soviet model of the Stalinist era than to a true democracy. And that has been a problem in Russian history for a long, long, long time.
Last month, Russians voted in local and regional elections. Putin's United Russia Party was wildly successful in those elections, and a steady trickle of reports of voter intimidation, of fraud, of harassment, and all sorts of other things has come in the wake of that election. They have parliamentary elections next year, and I think it's a foregone conclusion that the United Russia Party will again sweep to victory, and Putin's position will be even further entrenched.
Yeah, but, you know, it is easy and not inappropriate to demonize Putin. But the reality is that the United States, this is really important, the United States did not fulfill its obligations at the collapse of the Soviet Union. We set up a situation which allowed the kind of nationalist fervor that Putin represents.
You're absolutely correct. But I don't think that changes my assessment of Putin.
Oh, no.
And his position in Russian politics, nor the fact that he has at his disposal one of the world's largest nuclear arsenals.
How many bombs do we have and they have?
According to plowshares.org, which is an organization that keeps track of nuclear stockpiles around the world, there are officially in the world right now 15,695 nuclear weapons.
Wait a minute, 15,000?
15,695.
That's a lot of bang.
The United States and Russia account for about 93% of that stockpile. And this stock, 15,695, that number is two-thirds lower than it was at its peak in the mid-1980s.
I guess we should feel better about that.
Well, fewer nuclear weapons is a good thing. I think, in general, but there's still many times more than we need to obliterate human civilization as we know it.
Well, there you go.
So there you go. There are nine countries that have nuclear weapons now that we know of. Mm-hmm. The United States, Russia, France, China, the UK, Pakistan, India, Israel, unofficially.
Yes.
And now North Korea has recently joined the club. It should be noted, as a result of bad foreign policy under the previous Republican administration in the United States. Well, anyway, continue, please.
Oh, you've really depressed me. here's my thinking, and here's kind of why you and I are doing this show today, I suspect. It is wrong to think that people have learned from the past mistakes, that they've learned well enough that they can avoid nuclear war. Nuclear war is a thing that comes not out of a rational decision-making process, but a part of a slippery slope. It is now logically a weapon system. Nuclear weapons are now part of a weapon system that is a part of a continuum of extremely destructive devices. Just to use the example of Syria, the Syrian government of Assad uses what are called barrel bombs, essentially 55-gallon oil cans.
Drums.
Filled with explosives and pieces of fragmented metal, which are dropped on civilian populations with no warning. They explode, they tear people apart, they break buildings apart. They leave a lot of people wounded, actually more people wounded than dead, which is part of the purpose, I think. And this terror weapon is a part of a vast attempt by a petty dictator of a minor sect of Islam to maintain his power. And he becomes either our ally or our enemy, depending on which day of the week it is. We say we want to get rid of him, but in fact, the Soviets, the Russians, an easy mistake to make. The Russians have decided to put their bets on the Assad regime, which is not a new decision by them. And we are in the middle of a situation in that region which grows ever more complex. The growth of ISIS is a significant force in all of that. And religious fundamentalism, and I wouldn't care whether it was Jewish fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism, or Islamic fundamentalism, or as is the case in Burma, Buddhist fundamentalism. These things, to me, lead to disastrous consequences for human beings. And it terrifies me that this is now the normative thing. We know a lot more now about, for example, 9/11 and about the complete... You know, one of the reasons we know this is because the Republicans are fighting for the presidency. And the accusation has been made by Trump, of all people, and others, that really the Bush administration, the most recent Bush, failed to protect the United States against the attack of 9/11. And
Yes. That's what they call a self-evident truth, isn't it? Who was president when 9/11 happened?
Well, and there was warnings.
Yeah, there were plenty of warnings. But you know what's fascinating to me about American politics and culture?
What?
Is it's taken till now to have an honest, open discussion about that. For a long time, it was simply verboten and bad form and possibly treasonous to suggest that perhaps the Bush administration had failed to keep us safe and had ignored warnings about the 9/11 attacks.
Right. I don't want to... Look, people now listening to us are going to think about they're wanting to explain 9/11 in conspiratorial terms.
Yep, not going there today.
I don't want to go there. I'm not going to take those calls because I don't think there's any real value in that analysis. I think that the evidence is quite clear of what happened.
We're just not going to talk about
it. So let's just concentrate on our thesis, my thesis at least, that we are moving very, very close to the creation of World War III.
I think it might be helpful to go back and look at about the last 75, 80 years of history.
Oh, just 75 or 80 years?
Well, yeah. But specifically beginning with the October Revolution.
Wow.
The Bolshevik Revolution.
Yes.
In former Russia at the time. Now the Russia again. A lot of people consider that to be the most significant event of the 20th century, far more so than the two world wars, because it initiated the Soviet Empire that lasted, as it turned out, not quite as long as a lot of people expected.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would like you to do, sir.
Me?
Yes.
Me?
Take us through the fall of the Soviet Union in the late 1980s. Up to the present.
Well, the essential problem that the Soviet Union faced was that it was starved by the West to a great extent, and that its economic capabilities were strained by its desire to be a powerful player in the world stage militarily. On top of that, there really are some serious errors in the assumption that a state government can, as a central government, manage a complex economy.
In a totalitarian way,
right. So this became, essentially, the state apparatus became and replaced all of the complex elements that make up our system of quasi-competitive, because it isn't really, quasi-competitive capitalism. Meanwhile, the Soviets made an incredible mistake, the same one we're making, amazingly, of invading Afghanistan.
Yeah. So empires go to die.
Well, yeah, right. And this is something that, you know, anyone who's studies history should know. This is what really damaged the British in what was called the Great Game. This is something that has been a you know, go to Afghanistan and destroy your armies.
Stymied Alexander the Great.
Yeah,
Example after example. It's really
right.
Fun.
But we ignored that, and here we are now in a war that we thought, well, we were winning. And President Obama, who I consider to be an incredibly naive player in the international stage, said, okay, well, we can be out of there with only 1,000 troops in there. And now suddenly, like yesterday, we realize, oh, we need to keep the 10,000 that we've got stuck there. You know, so Afghanistan is still the endless war. Yeah. And meanwhile, a huge, huge right-wing movement criticizing Obama for pulling out of Iraq, despite the fact that the Iraqis kind of ordered us out. I mean, ignoring all that historical factors, we now find ourselves stuck. It's kind of the tar baby analogy, not to be too racist here, but it's that notion that there's something that tempts us in and doesn't let us go. And we are now stuck once again in that region with no foreseeable way to withdraw, either honorably or dishonorably. It is very, very dangerous. And it has ignited old fundamentalist wounds in a world, really, where those kinds of things have been immensely destructive in previous history. And all of that dates back to Western rebuildings or attempts to rebuild quasi-nation states after World War I with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. Meanwhile, Turkey has rewritten its own history, denies its horrors toward the Armenians. This is all a world built of fictions and fantasies, on top of which, in American politics, there is a crazy Republican Party. I have to say that. It's not the conservative party of Eisenhower or others.
No, clearly.
It's a very weird.
Nixon.
Well, it's a very weird. I mean, these are people who deny evolution. These are people who accuse Planned Parenthood of murdering babies, who are on a crazy course. And they have found in Donald Trump, who is, aside from real estate investment, a true idiot and a blowhard, and the head of the clown circus, as far as I'm concerned. And he is, I am very afraid, likely to be the candidate of the Republican Party. On the other side, on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders is probably unable to gain power enough to actually have a social Democratic candidate for president as the candidate of the Democratic Party, which leads us with Hillary Clinton, who is a neocon.
Uh-huh.
And who has followed a line, she and her husband, which is essentially a Cold Warrior stance.
Well, that was all fascinating. But how does that get us from the fall of the Soviet Union to today?
Well, gasp.
Wait, before you start.
This is
KBOO, 90.7 FM.
Okay.
This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. We're taking your calls, and I noticed there are a couple of you standing by. We'll get to you in a moment. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You can also comment on our Facebook page, Facebook.com/Abe and Joe. All right, fall of the Soviet Union. What happens to Russia after that?
Well, there was an in the effort to build an extremely patriotic nation after the invasion by the Nazis, a strong military industrial complex in its own right developed in the then Soviet Union.
Which was there already, to be fair.
Well, it was there already because it had fought a civil war and it had to fight the West. People don't remember this, but the fact of the matter is expeditionary forces of the English and the Americans were involved in trying to crush the Red Revolution back after World War I.
Okay, so big military apparatus, the Soviet Union falls.
Yes.
And there we enter into a sort of a Wild West economy.
In Russia.
A kleptocracy, I've heard it described.
Well, I think so. What ends up happening is the old commissars, the old bureaucrats of the Soviet system flip, become capitalists, grab up what they can, and become the power force behind a so-called capitalist system.
So things are pretty chaotic.
Yes.
Resource extraction and the selling of those resources to the West, to Europe primarily, becomes the economic backbone of the new Russia. And you have the emergence of a group of oligarchs who wield vastly disproportionate economic and political influence in Russia.
Yeah, it's not unlike, almost a parallel to the oligarchs, we don't call them oligarchs, the leaders of the capitalist West. Mm-hmm. So you have this bizarre situation where there is not peaceful competition, but always competition with the implication that if all else fails, war becomes virtually inevitable. And the place where this is playing out right now, not the only place, but the place where it's playing out right now, is the Middle East. And it is, to my thinking, extremely dangerous situation. Vladimir Putin is not my kind of a guy. And the United States is in the thrall of a bizarre kind of, I don't know what to call it, end time philosophy on the right, which is really serious and may well come to dominate American politics in the foreseeable future. That can only lead to situations where one or two miscalculations lead to war and very possibly nuclear war.
Credit where it's due. Putin is smart. He's ruthless. and he's politically brilliant. He's a former high-ranking spy with the former KGB, stationed in Germany. He's fluent in German and well-versed in the culture and politics of Western Europe.
True.
And like we mentioned earlier, he's now in his third six-year term as mm-hmm. president of Russia. And he is pretty firmly entrenched as the dictator of that country.
Yeah, I don't think he is
formidable.
Yeah, he really is. And I think he finds us kind of amusing.
Yeah, maybe so. But under Putin, we see a Russia with resurgent imperialist ambitions. He's, for all intents and purposes, annexed the eastern third of Ukraine, including the Crimea. He is a backer of the Assad regime in Syria. The extent of that backing is not apparent to a lot of Americans. The Russians have their only Mediterranean naval base on the Syrian coast. So they have a vested geopolitical interest in propping up the Assad regime, not only because of Syria's role in the greater Middle Eastern resource economy, but because through Syria, Russia is able to project military force in the Mediterranean region.
That's all that is true. I don't know whether I would call it, I don't know if I would call it imperialist in the same sense of the United States playing.
I don't know. Russia just grabbed a bunch more territory. That appears to be imperialist.
My reaction also is that from the perspective of the Russian people and the Russian government, the loss of places like Ukraine are now a grievous injury. If we had followed the agreed-upon plan, and most Americans don't even know it was an agreed-upon plan, if we'd followed the agreed-upon plan to demilitarize the former Soviet republics and the client states, we would not be in this situation. But in fact, this was an opportunity for NATO to move into lands where there was no real competition, and now we're there.
Again, credit where it's due. I'm not a big fan of Bill Clinton, but an enduring legacy of his presidency was his leadership on reducing and eliminating the nuclear stockpiles in many of the former Soviet republics outside of Russia, mm-hmm. places like Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Uzbekistan, and so on and so forth. That was a far-sighted stroke of genius, in my opinion.
Well, it was, you know, first, Clinton is a mixed bag in all kinds of ways. It is true that we have reduced the nuclear stockpiles, and it is true that wild client states out of the former Soviet republics have disappeared, largely, we think. But the fact of the matter is that there is absolutely no question that Russia sees itself now as a player extending its power and its influence into the Mediterranean, which has always been one of their things. And the great game of Afghanistan remains to be played.
Let's take some phone calls.
Okay.
All right. Who do we have, Steve? Jeff, good morning.
Well, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for this this program. I think it's incredibly important. And the debate on Ukraine and Crimea is very interesting, and the historical facts you bring up. By the way, the Russians have a base in the Black Sea, in Crimea, which is very important to them. But I'd like to take you back to the beginning, where I think it's so important, the speech that you brought up, which I think is the most quoted and least understood speech in American history.
And you're talking about the Eisenhower.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much for playing that. And what you didn't mention is that Eisenhower, in addition to his role in Europe and World War II and all that, was immersed in the creation of the secret and the space industry, the creation and expansion of the CIA and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knew that whole industry from the inside out. And so when he told us about the military-industrial complex, when he warned us, and by the way, he talked a lot about academia and the laboratories, and that's so we could really call it the military-industrial academic complex. He knew like no one else wherein he spoke, and he gave us a very grave warning. And he told us, if you play the whole speech, it makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up.
Agreed. Because yeah.
He told us what was going to happen. He said, your choice, boys. You got it.
He was dead on. Well, dead on.
Yeah, and there's a new book about Alan Dulles, who was head of the CIA, and then, of course, the brother of John Foster Dulles. These were lawyers well-placed in the centers of power in the United States. And Alan Dulles gave us an incredible, horrible series of coups in Latin America to maintain that region, essentially supporting the United Fruit Company in Central America, essentially opposing, of course, the government of Fidel Castro. The attempt to oust Castro under the direction of that CIA led to the dumping of Alan Dulles as head of the CIA. And here's what's really creepy to me. The great conspiracy theory of our age, who the hell killed Kennedy, begins to look more and more, and I'm going to say this, like a CIA coup. You're silent or you left?
No. I'm listening. and one might say, why would think otherwise? But and I also like to remind you of a little fact. You're talking about the World Wars and World War One, and Adolf Hitler would have said its extension, World War Two,
right.
Did not begin as a world war. It began not too far from the Middle East as a colonial conflict, as somebody who was trying to get rid of colonial power, and just a little assassination. And what do you know? You've got war for half a century almost, in leading into a Cold War, I guess. And
right.
And so when you say welcome to World War III, you could have said welcome to, you know, a century of warfare, half a century, when an archduke was shot, and people would have said, you're crazy. How could that lead to a world war? But it did very quickly.
More like welcome to Act III of the ongoing world war.
I hope not.
Well, I mean, and we don't remember, but we all need to reach back in our historical memories and realize that in World War I, the working class was sent to kill the working classes of Europe. And the unjust end of that war, the collapse of the Imperial German forces, the collapse of the old Ottoman Empire and so on, lead directly, as you suggest, to the problems we're in right now, including an incredible rise in anti-Semitism, always a problem in Europe, and to the creation of the State of Israel, and to the creation of the so-called potential two-state solution to the Palestine question, and to all of the problems of our dependence on oil from places like Saudi Arabia, our ally, which is a fascist country run by a monarchy in the most reactionary form, which kills people, cuts their hands off, does all kinds of stuff to maintain its power. This is a really bad situation. We have bad allies, and we are supposedly being pragmatic, but the great dangers of the situation are enormous. Meanwhile, the opposing Shia Islam in its state representation in Iran continues to be perceived by the U.S. as simply bothersome. We also forget that it was during World War II that basically Iran had very briefly a democratic government. We feared Soviet influence in that region. The Dulles CIA engineered a coup, I think at 54 it was, 53, 54, and the consequence of that was the putting in place of the Shah, who used a terrifying secret police, the Savak, to control the people. When that collapsed, a reaction took place where the Democrats, as it were, small d, in Iran, lost control to the fundamental religious forces, and that's the situation we're in now. And finally, to Obama's credit, to his administration's credit, we have negotiated a way to limit the potential for nuclear weapons in the hands of the Iranians. But the entire Republican establishment and the State of Israel, which is incredibly influential in public opinion in this country, are all opposed to that, seeing it as a potentially deadly decision and a deadly agreement. So, woo!
Hey, thank you very much for the call.
Could I ask one more thing? Because sadly, this is all interconnected. But I'd like to take you back to the beginning and say, well, in my interpretation of that speech is that Eisenhower came to us and said, sorry, guys, I've created a monster, and it's going to be a giant problem for you. And so could you address the subject of is it possible to take his word seriously and do something about it?
Well, it's always possible to do something about it till it isn't.
Thank you very much for the call. I think we'll answer your answer offline.
Well, No, sure. I think he makes, like, what? He's saying, well, what do we do about it?
It's a question of will. We decide, it's a question of will and the priorities. We decide we're going to invest somewhere else. We decide to reduce our stockpiles of weapons. We decide to stop building more of them. We put our time and our energy and our money instead into cultivating positive reciprocal relationships with other cultures around the world. A series of decisions. Not impossible.
But you know that the Obama administration is modernizing the nuclear bomb.
I realize that. But that doesn't change the truth of what I'm saying to you right now. I'm preaching to you, Joe. Can you hear me?
Well, I hear you, but I don't think the American people hear you. I think most people bask in a patriotic ignorance and rarely participate in politics, finding it either distressingly cynical or boring.
Bread and circuses, absolutely.
Yeah. And the consequence of that, occasionally populations can be mobilized, as in the case of Obama's election in 2008, but that isn't so often the case. And in fact, probably the next presidential election is going to be the weirdest in modern times, where we're going to have, I really believe, that the clown Hitler.
Come on now.
No, I believe it. The clown Hitler Trump is going to be the nominee of the Republican Party. I didn't think this. I said it as a joke a few months ago, but the kind of charismatic dumbness, stupidity that characterizes him really reads well to about a third of American voters.
I disagree with you that he'll be the nominee, but I don't want to get sidetracked doing a conversation about that quite yet. We're still more than a year away from
that. Yeah, you don't want to talk about that because you think it's far enough away that we don't need to worry about it.
I do. I don't think he'll be the nominee, but again, I don't want to go there today. I do want to touch on something that you alluded to just now and our caller alluded to as well, and that's this notion of American exceptionalism. American exceptionalism can be pretty well understood by people like Donald Trump and also high-ranking conservatives in the American government. This idea that there is something intrinsic about our Americanness that makes what we do right, that legitimizes our actions, that but on the flip side, delegitimizes any good ideas that other nations might have. Mm-hmm. This notion that somehow because we are the first of the modern democracies, which is something of which we should be justifiably proud, somehow means that history ended with the formation of the United States and that the pitfalls and the traps that doomed other formerly powerful civilizations somehow don't apply to us. And this American exceptionalism also finds its expression in ideas that you hear again from Republican presidential candidates about how somehow the application of military force is the fastest, best, and most reasonable solution to any problem we might encounter on the international stage.
Right, and this
is folly on a grand scale.
Well, we have the Vietnam War as an absolute demonstration of that, and now we have the endless wars in the Middle East and in Central Asia as another demonstration of that. But it's really important also to remember that the national mythology of our creation is bull you know what. It really is. This nation was created in the interest of the planter class and the newly evolving business class in America. It excluded women. It excluded persons who didn't own property. It excluded
people of color.
People of color and turned them, legitimized slavery, legitimized the destruction of Native Americans. This is our history.
Agreed. I should not say people of color in this context because that's a bit of a dodge. It excluded black people who were owned by white people.
Right.
Let's be very clear on that.
Right. And we still see, I mean, there was just an item on Amy Goodman about the fight over the getting rid of the Civil War flag, of the Confederate flag in Mississippi. I mean, this is craziness. And yet, it is part of our cultural garbage.
Our mythology, yes. Okay, I will grant you all that. But I will also add that to our enduring credit, with nearly every generation, we have expanded the franchise. We have expanded the circle of equals. We have welcomed women and black people and other people of color as voting citizens of the United States. We have progressed beyond the mythology that we started with.
But unlike Europe, we don't have a strong left of any sort.
No.
No social democratic party like France has, like Germany has, like Sweden has.
Agreed.
Like Denmark
I'm not saying
has.
We don't have a long way to go.
And we have an incredibly powerful and growingly strong know-nothing right wing.
You're absolutely correct.
Well, hence I say Donald Trump is coming, going to get your mama.
But to suggest that we have not progressed since our founding is.
Well, I'm not suggesting we have not progressed. Okay. In all kinds of ways we've progressed. But I don't know that these advances are adequate to deal with the oncoming onslaught of what I consider to be friendly fascism.
All right. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, poet, critic, and columnist Katha Pollitt speaks on the fate of legal abortion. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, Raina Masri discusses the death, chaos, and destruction in Beirut, Lebanon. Also, Unaid Ahmad analyzes the decision by the U.S. to stay in Afghanistan. At 11, Stage and Studio presents the Breast Cancer Monologues, a documentary for Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Andre Middleton speaks with Yvonne Kennedy, an artist from Mexico who recently showed her paintings at the Alexander Gallery at Clackamas Community College. All this and more coming up today on KBOO.
All good stuff.
Let's go to the phones.
Yes. Who's next? 231-8187.
Who do we got, Steve? Whom do we have? Cullen. Did I get that right?
Yep, you got it right.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks, you guys, for this conversation, and thanks for starting with Eisenhower's speech. That's one of my favorite outgoing president speeches. I wanted to kind of bring a point here, too, in this whole discussion. That is, you know, Eisenhower used the term of industrial. And at that point in his, you know, exit, he was just trying to help the people recognize that we now have this huge industry, it's a money-making industry. Mm-hmm. And in that process, you know, that wasn't going away is what he's basically stating at the, you know, at the level we were increasing.
Right. Well, he saw its influence to be very, very powerful. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so he saw that thing as this machine that was moving that had such a force it wasn't going to be stopped. And so you fast forward, you go through Vietnam, the money made there. You look at, you know, where then you look at the George, you know, Jr. administration comes in and says, well, now we're going to take this whole thing. We're actually going to privatize it. So we're going to give it away to people who want to invest in the money-making scheme of war profiteering, if you will, you know? And so you have this huge industry now, and it's massive, billion, multi-billion dollar industry, probably in the trillions, actually, if you look at the overall scheme of it. And then Putin, and just to get back to one of the things that a friend of mine had posted this on Facebook, I thought was fascinating. He was in this talk show, and he brought up a very interesting thing about the involvement that we have in the Middle East at this point. And just to get to the privatization of war here, he said, you know, you have hired mercenaries fighting as rebel forces.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and one of the problems you have now is that these guys go to the highest bidder. So we've literally created a scenario in which people are out there using our weaponry to fight wars, but if someone's willing to pay them more, they'll go fight for the other side.
Well, I don't know about that. I'm not sure that they aren't fundamentalist patriots. But I take your point. I mean, we really do have all kinds of industrial capitalist devices to wage war and very little to stop it.
Yeah, and so the one point I just want to make, too, is that it moved from a governmental, you know, oversight, supposedly, into how we went to war and how that was actually, you know, the process and the checks and balances system that's supposed to be involved in that. Just to get to the comment that you made about having World War III, I think this is just quite literally World War III is just a massive, never-ending conflict going on all the time to feed the industrial-military complex, because it is now a venture capital thing. It's no longer just us going because we see a wrong in the world or something that we disagree with. This is more of just keeping the venture capital in motion at this point, because we now have an enemy out there. And, you know, thank you to George Bush Jr. For bringing this to us, is that we can't see in a war that will never end. And there's absolutely no way that someday is going to say, well, thank God we finally rid the world of terrorists. You know, we do have this never-ending industrial, you know, military complex that is doing nothing but growing. And if you look at even cyber wars and everything that's going on now, it's just so huge. It's so completely out of control that I'm only saying this because I have a very close friend that invests money in the market. He says it's huge money invest in these corporations.
Sure. So, yeah. The United States Armed Forces have become the hired muscle of the investor class, essentially. It exists to protect our commercial interests around the world. We haven't defended freedom. And, you know, those of you who have served in uniform and you find yourself offended by what I'm saying right now, I apologize for that. But I urge you to consider the truth of what I'm saying. The United States has not gone to war to protect our freedoms since 1945.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. And I want to just comment on what you just said, because I feel the same way about those in uniform, too, is that I feel I honor them for the intention of why they're going out there. But that, you know, we haven't divulged the truth to them in over, a half of a century, of why they're really going to war, what the true purpose of that is. But anyway, I just wanted to bring that part of it in, because when you use the word industrial, he's basically saying we created an industry, and this thing's out of control.
You're right.
And here we are today, it's big money, and that's, I don't think it's the end. They don't intend it to ever actually end. In fact, a friend of mine said to me perfect once, he said, the reason why we keep the Middle East unstable is solely for the purpose of keeping this thing moving. We want it unstable. There's a purpose for keeping it unstable.
Well, I don't know about conscious purposefulness, but it certainly is unstable, and it certainly does suit the interests of the military-industrial complex. It is also the case that by turning away from a draft, many of us fought against the draft during the Vietnam era, thinking that would help end wars. It turned out what it did create is a situation where the economy, in its dips, creates a situation where the poorest of us and the least educated of us and the most needy for jobs turn to development of their own lives as military figures. And I know many people who had joined the military, young men and women, because this was a job opportunity that existed and nothing else did for them. So, it's really, 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 really what Eisenhower said, but in many more dimensions than he could have predicted. And I thank you for the call, man.
Yeah, and one more comment on just what you said right there, because that's a very big point in what you just said. There's a very strong purpose for middle class disappearing, because people are going to take those opportunities you just said in the military out of lack of desperation for something they need to do to either educate themselves or do something with their lives.
Exactly.
And so we now have that scenario going along with, because the middle class is diminishing. They've created a scenario in which people will do whatever they can to survive. So thank you for the show, you guys. It's always entertaining.
Well, thank you. Okay, 231-8187. Should we take another call?
Yeah, I think we got time for that. George, good morning.
Good morning. I don't want to interrupt a fascinating development of an analysis of our foreign domestic policy by our ruling elites, but the announced purpose of your program earlier on KABU was that it was to do with the Ukraine. But I'm enjoying the conversation here and the discussion, and if you want to go back to the Ukraine for a minute, I just wonder if you would comment on the present agricultural and industrial importance of the Ukraine to the economy of the region, and whether that represents something that has been going on since about 1890 with some interruptions from the war. Or wars, and if not, I'd say continue with this fascinating discussion.
Okay, well, thank you for the call, man.
Sure, bye.
just by the by, Ukraine was and still is the breadbasket of that region. Always was,
It's true, yeah.
And it's a real plum, and it's certainly understandable why Russia would like to regain it. And what it's done, actually, Putin has been more or less thwarted. The two sides in the Ukrainian struggle right now are kind of equally matched, and it would require much more effort for the Russians to take it back, or for the Western powers to take back the parts that have been seized by the Russian proxy government.
True.
But there's another aspect to this, which is the regaining essentially of the Crimean holdings of Russia, which I think is actually a legitimate effort.
And we should notice, too, that it looms large in the Russian psyche to have a sort of buffer zone between it and Western Europe after having been squeezed over the centuries by France, by Germany, by Austria. That belief that they need some sort of insulation is pretty strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's take another phone call. Phil, good morning.
Good morning. Say, I think we need to realize there is some positive aspects of this whole war machine in that what else are we going to do with our depleted uranium?
Well, you know, I'll tell you a real quick story.
Ever the optimist.
Well, yes. I we don't have much time, but when I was doing commercial radio, I was invited onto the battleship New Jersey, which remember made a call here way back, and I was taken around the ship, and one of the things I found was that the last ditch defense against missiles and airplanes attacking the ship was these Gatling guns, which had savats, that is, coverings on the bullets. The bullets fired by that rapid firing weapon were depleted uranium. And it turns out depleted uranium is radioactive, yes, but it explodes on contact. It drills through steel. It is an incredibly and very heavy. It is a very, very effective weapon. And we used it in the wars in Iraq, pardon me. And we're running out of time. And I want to thank you all and urge you to stay tuned to KBOO, where discussion flourishes and good ideas go to die.
We'll be back at you next week.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Jacko as part of the We Real Cool KBOO at the Clinton Jazz Film Series on Thursday, October 22nd at 7 p.m. Jacko tells the story of Jaco Pastorius, a self-taught, larger-than-life musician who changed the course of modern music. Never-before-seen archival footage unveils the story of Jaco's life, his music, his demise, and the lasting victory of artistic genius. Again, that's Jacko, Thursday, October 22nd, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information about films and screening times can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, poet, critic, and columnist Katha Pollack speaks on the fate of legal abortion. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre.